My guest at this time is Dr. Arthur C. Brooks. He is the president of the American Enterprise Institute and the author of the recently published New York Times bestseller, The Conservative Heart, How to Build a Fairer, Happier, and More Prosperous America. And Dr. Brooks, thanks so much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks for having me.
A big portion of the book is focused on the fact that you believe, obviously, conservatives have better ideas for how to lift people out of poverty, but they don't communicate it well. And in a lot of ways, they're surrendering the language when it comes to this debate. And one example of that is the term social justice. It's one we usually hear in connection with a more liberal or even progressive approach to policy. But you say it's one that conservatives should embrace and make sure it's defined in a way that the people understand where conservatives are coming from. What do you mean by that?
Well, absolutely. And I was trying to do two things by writing this book. Number one is to show conservatives, because conservatives are not even convinced, I've found, that they have the best solutions for people in poverty. And so it's to show incontrovertible proof that if you believe in poverty reduction, like I do, that you must be a fiscal conservative and you must have conservative values. That's number one. And number two, that we can talk about it in a way that will be really compelling to people. And this is one of the examples that I give in the book. I have a whole chapter in the book, by the way, called How to Talk So People Will Listen, the Seven Habits of Highly Effective Conservatives. And my guarantee is if, when readers get this and they read it, this is a debate training manual I've used with members of Congress for 7 years now. First time I've made it available to the public. And, you know, if our listeners, they read it and they pay attention to it, I guarantee you'll never lose another argument to your obnoxious left-wing sister-in-law at Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, this stuff is really going to change. I've found just on the basis of working with congressmen that this changes the way people talk and the way that people will listen to us, and part of that is stealing the language and icons of the other side. Conservatives never say social justice. Why not? We believe in social justice. We just define it differently. And by the way, the way that we define social justice, the way we define fairness, the way we define compassion, these are the definitions that the majority of Americans share. So it's time for us to start talking that way.
In that same section, you say true conservative social justice must also fight cronyism that favors powerful interests and keeps the little guy down. As you well know, Dr. Brooks, there's a lot of people in this country who think that's true across both parties. So how do you chip away at that when it's a big problem on both sides of the aisle?
Well, the most important thing that we have to do is to be fair and to say what the truth is all the time, whether or not it's in the interest of people who vote Republican or not, quite frankly. I mean, we have a moral obligation to look out for the people who need us the most, which is to say people who have been shut out of the opportunity society too much in recent years. Mobility is too low in this country, and conservatives have to stand up and say, yes, I recognize that mobility is stagnant and that poverty is entrenched. It doesn't matter if people vote Democrat, people vote Republican. We have a moral obligation to stand up for the people who need our opportunity society. And one of the things that's in the way of that is very powerful people that are gaming the system, particularly at the corporate level, to make sure that they can be in front of the line, in front of the little guys out there. And it's not right. We have to stand up and denounce it.
Dr. Brooks, you also say in the book that for the most part, people who are on government assistance, and that's a big part of the issue with the level of poverty and the way to get out of it, and we'll get into this in a couple different ways, but when it comes to issues like food stamps, you say it's an easy target for conservatives to talk about in ways to reduce the entitlement culture in Washington. You say, though, that most people who are on food stamps and other forms of government dependence actually want to work. Others would say that back in the 90s, when it actually became a requirement to either search for work or put in some work in order to get welfare assistance, all of a sudden we had a lot more able-bodied adults working their way into the system. So what's the evidence for the fact that most people on assistance actually don't want to be there?
When you poll people who are on public assistance, there's virtually nobody you will find who says, I would prefer to have my kids see me get food stamps as opposed to a paycheck. People prefer to earn what they get, but they don't see the opportunity. This is the reason that the welfare reform that required work was such a good idea, and it's such a crime that we've rolled it back in the age of Obama in this country. People simply don't see the opportunities that are right in front of them, and in many cases, the opportunities don't exist. We have to work together to make sure that we have more of a culture of work and more of an expectation of work, and in so doing, we're going to be helping people while not stripping away the benefits that they actually need. Let's give people the benefit of the doubt. about. Nobody wants to just loaf. I mean, some people do. We've all got kind of a lazy brother-in-law someplace. I mean, everybody's got that in their families. But the vast majority of poor people with whom I've worked, and I've worked a lot in poor communities, they don't see opportunity. We have to make opportunity more manifest in our society.
And then you say when it comes to reducing the entitlement culture, there is a lot of room for cutting there because there are a lot of people who aren't really poor that are still figured out a way to get on to government assistance. How do you go about figuring out who those people are, especially when any cuts to entitlements are obviously going to meet with fierce liberal and probably media resistance?
Well, one of the fact that politicians say that's impossible is because they're not good leaders. They're followers is what it comes down to. The definition of leadership is inducing people to do something that's difficult on behalf of the whole society. Great leaders can take a country to war, yet we don't have leaders today who can reform our entitlements. The entitlement system that we have, the creaking entitlement system, which is completely unsustainable, is imperiling the safety net completely. We're going to have austerity. Just look at Greece. That's down the road for us at some point. And the people who will suffer are not the rich. They never are. It's always the poor. So if we love the poor, we have a responsibility to avoid austerity, and that means we have to be solvent. And to be solvent means we must be fiscal conservatives. We have to have real leaders who have hard conversations about what the entitlement system should look like. Now, you don't have to throw somebody out on the street or take away benefits that they've actually earned. You simply have to have some common sense approaches to it. The fact that we have leaders who are so poor as leaders, they can't even broach the conversation about what the retirement age ought to be when people are living longer and longer, is just more evidence that we're incapable of doing hard things.
We're talking with Arthur Brooks. The book is The Conservative Heart, How to Build a Fairer, Happier, and More Prosperous America. You talk about how the first step towards getting to this point of putting in a more conservative and compassionate and expressly compassionate agenda has taken place with the Tea Party movement. Number one, launch a rebellion. That's how you go from a protest movement to a social movement. Check mark. That's been done. But you say there's three other steps here that really need to be done. And so far that hasn't happened. Those are declare majoritarian values, claim the moral high ground, and unite the country behind an agenda. So how do you go from that first step to getting the other three in line?
Well, you look at how other great social movements have formed themselves. If you go back to the late 1950s and early 1960s, the civil rights movement was a protest movement. It was protesting against discrimination, and rightly so, by the way. But it would have stayed a protest movement. The civil rights movement, as we currently understand it, would have become irrelevant as the Black Panthers became, because they stayed a protest movement. What Dr. Martin Luther King did is he claimed majoritarian status. He said, look, this is what we all believe. This is written in the Declaration of Independence, that we're all created equal by our Creator and endowed with certain inalienable rights, all of us. He moved on to the moral case. He basically said, and people agreed, that if you are a racist, if you're barring people from particular services and the ability to live in full citizenship because of somebody's color of their skin, it's wrong. It's morally wrong. And finally, to unite the whole country behind it as a matter of optimism, as a matter of national pride, that's what he did. So let's look at those other movements and say, look, the Tea Party movement, which is a freedom movement, it's a movement about empowerment of individuals. It's basically saying we should be in charge as people. It has to, first of all, think, who are the people for whom we are fighting? Is it me? No. It's the people who need us the most. These are the people who, by the way, sometimes don't even know they need us. Go from fighting against government institutions to fighting for people that are being held down and denied their equal rights to the pursuit of happiness, and you're going to be on track to starting a social movement, not just a protest movement.
Last topic, but one you mentioned early on in our conversation, and the key, as you said, to being a much more effective debater for conservative principles. You've got a 7 Habits of Highly Effective Conservatives chapter. They include be a moralist, fight for people, not against things, get happy, steal all the best arguments, go where you're not welcome, say it in 30 seconds, break your bad habits. Where are conservatives doing the worst on this, and where are they doing better?
Well, the biggest place where conservatives are doing the worst right now, I got to say it, get happy. Nobody wants to follow somebody who's grim, at least not for very long. And for a really long time, we've gone to people who could be with us. They're sort of persuadable. They know something's wrong in this country. And we've looked like we're just the Republicans in particular, the party of anger. No, the Republican Party only wins when it's the party of aspiration. Just ask, you know, the people who worked with Ronald Reagan. He threw away the playbook of malaise and throwing insults around and saying that everybody's stupid. And he said, no, 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 it's morning in America, guys. We're going to fight for everyone. He was a true happy warrior. That's what conservatives are kind of getting wrong right now. Conservatives are going to have a very good year in 2016 if they become the happy, optimistic, aspirational party about a new day in America. But if they don't, if they continue with this competing pessimisms with the Democrats, look, Hillary Clinton's probably going to be the nominee. What a pessimist. She's always talking about how lousy things are and how lousy the Republicans are. And we're answering in kind. We're insulting each other. We have candidates who says that everybody in Washington is fat and stupid, basically. That's pessimism. That will lose. That will be a horrible year in 2016 for Republicans unless they get this right.
And very quickly, without revealing any endorsements you don't want to reveal, who among the litany of Republican candidates, whether you think they're the best candidate or not, is doing the best job of messaging these days?
Well, there's a lot of difficulty going on because of the warfare that's going on between the candidates, which has happened much earlier, and the dynamics have been pretty confusing, as of course you know and the listeners know right now. But that said, a lot of the mainstream candidates are really struggling to show that they're pro-poor, that they're pro-opportunity, that they're in favor of a society that lifts more people up, and the conservatives are for that. I like a lot of what Marco Rubio is talking about when he talks about poverty. Jeb Bush's right to rise concept is right on. John Kasich is fearless when it comes to what he's trying to do. You agree with him or disagree with him, he's a fearless guy. Chris Christie, I mean, I don't know where he is in the polls right now, but you know, he's going places and talking to people that have never even talked to conservatives before because he thinks they need his message. These are very mainstream guys, and they're doing a lot of the right thing. And if this persists and this expands, it could be a very good year for the Republicans.
We'll be watching, and we'll see how many take your advice. There's certainly plenty who have the opportunity to. Dr. Brooks, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Arthur C. Brooks is president of the American Enterprise Institute. His New York Times bestselling book is The Conservative Heart, How to Build a Fairer, Happier, and More Prosperous America. I'm Greg Corumbus reporting for Radio America.